Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 21st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing municipal broadband, including its federalism implications. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome four experts to our call today, one of whom is going to serve as our moderator. She's Rachel M. Bender, Senior Policy Director at Mobile Future, and I'm going to leave the introductions of the other guests to her. So with that, Ms. Bender, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and again, welcome everybody to today's Federalist Society Teleforum, What's the Download on Municipal Broadband? Today's Teleforum is sponsored by the Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, and we have some great speakers here ready to talk about the role of municipally owned and operated broadband networks in the United States. So please let me introduce our speakers, and then we'll get right into opening remarks. Today we have with us Charles Davidson, the Director of the Advanced Communications Law and Policy Institute at New York Law School, Randy May, the President of the Free State Foundation, and Chris Mitchell, the Director of Community Broadband Networks for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. So Charles, would you like to kick us off with some opening remarks?
Sure. Thank you very much, and thank you both for the invitation to participate. This is, you know, really a critical issue and one that provokes a lot of passionate debate. There's a lot of passion because the debate over whether and when government should enter the broadband space and compete with the private sector hits on a number of issues that are fundamentally important to our country and to our democracy. You know, the debate really hits on notions of free enterprise, notions of capitalism, philosophic tenets of the size and scope of government, competition policy, and the state of broadband. You know, this debate, in short, I think, is really a microcosm of so many other discussions and debates in the broadband arena and in the political arena, especially when it comes to state-federal relations. In all of our work on these issues, and we've done a fair amount over the past 10 years, we acknowledge and appreciate the passion that these issues spark. It's in that context, the very passionate and philosophic debates, that we nevertheless try to stick to data in an effort to ensure that all the decision makers have the information they need to make informed decisions. Ultimately, as citizens of a democracy, we want our decision makers to make informed and not emotional decisions. You know, making sure that the entire story about government networks is told in an impartial and data-driven manner is a big part of our focus. We issued a report last year that drilled down into the array of arguments and data points put forward by ardent pro-GONS advocates, and our findings were a bit contrary to the story being told in some quarters about how municipal broadband is mostly a positive thing that yields more benefits than cost. Ultimately, building a broadband network, which is a very dynamic and complex system, requires a significant amount of upfront capital to deploy and significant recurring capital to maintain, to operate and upgrade. So owning and running a broadband network is a very risky venture for any entity, let alone local governments whose primary experience is with maintaining infrastructure and keeping the roads paved. And, you know, even with just the purely physical infrastructure that doesn't have to be maintained, upgraded, reinvested in, it's a challenge at times for local governments to maintain the roads, bridges, water, wastewater systems, et cetera. You know, to date, a major part of the pro-GONS advocacy that we've seen, and this has been embraced by the current FCC, the president, and other federal actors, is the notion that these broadband networks are not so complex, expensive, or risky. You know, advocates tend to point to successes in places like Chattanooga to assuage concerns and justify the risk. In our opinion, this advocacy overlooks several key facts about government-owned networks in the U.S. First, there have been many systems that have failed. And failure here includes not just bankruptcy and having to sell off the system, which has happened in a lot of places like Groton, Connecticut, Provo, Utah, et cetera. Failure also includes failure to deliver the benefits promised at the start. You know, many systems have failed to become financially sustainable, and local governments have had to assume more debt or dip into general tax funds to prop up the failing systems. This occurred in Monticello, Minnesota, Burlington, Vermont, with Utopia. And these actions have resulted in cities' credit ratings being downgraded, which ultimately has a direct impact on their financial viability. Second, many of the successes that we hear about are, frankly, the result of very unique circumstances that are difficult, if not impossible, to replicate. Chattanooga is a key example here. Third, there are very few examples of sustainable successes in this space. For as much as a particular system might be perceived as succeeding now, there is little data to demonstrate that it will do so over the long haul. The data, the analysis just aren't there. The debt obligations for many systems are significant. Moreover, private companies are responding by upgrading networks, offering new services, and the vast majority of these networks are deployed in areas that are already served by multiple ISPs. Such competitive pressure has had or will likely have negative impacts on muni systems since, frankly, private companies are much more nimble, have deeper pockets, sustainable business models, and they have fewer constraints when it comes to competing in the long haul. So for these and other reasons, you know, state legislators are right to be concerned about municipal broadband in their states, which is why the FCC's preemption of laws impacting GON deployment in Tennessee and North Carolina is troubling. And I know Randy's going to get into the legal aspects a bit. And I would just like to, you know, reiterate that state legislators should have unfettered ability to develop legislative frameworks for government-owned networks that make the most sense in the context of their state. And with regard to FCC preemption of duly considered state laws impacting muni broadband, this does represent a significant federal outreach that in all likelihood will be struck down on constitutional grounds. With that, I know Randy's touching upon the legal aspects in a bit. I will wrap up and hand it over to Chris.
Thank you, Charles. And I want to thank everyone for bringing me into this debate. I've long followed the arguments of you, Charles, and Randy, and I know that I have the contrary opinion, but I appreciate you having the debate because I think these discussions are very much important for crucial policy areas, public policy today. Actually, I think I agree more with a lot of people on this call than particularly people calling in than others might suspect. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance is focused on keeping economic and political power local, and so we're actually much more hesitant about federal power and state power as well. We're strong proponents of subsidiarity, the idea that decisions should be made as close to the people as is practical. Now, when it comes to municipal networks, I think, you know, today we're going to be debating it in academic terms to some extent, and I really want to get into the data in the Q&A. But on the ground, it's important to recognize the communities are not really doing that. They're responding to pressing concerns. And when they decide whether or not to engage in this business, it's often because they feel that if they don't, their vitality is at stake. And a good example of that is Franklin, Kentucky, where the municipality had no interest in providing internet access until local businesses came to them and said, you know, we're afraid that we're going to have to move our businesses to another location because we can't get the kind of connectivity we need from the incumbent, who is AT&T in this case. You know, AT&T was not willing to invest in the kind of high-quality services at a reasonable rate that these businesses needed. And so the utility owned by the city built out a fiber line and has expanded that to some other businesses over time for the same reasons. So this is something we see in city after city. They get involved because local businesses feel that they cannot be competitive in their industries because of a failure in the broadband market. Now, we also know that people are making real estate decisions based on internet availability, and this is more and more obvious every day. There's just some studies done in terms of the impact of fiber optic cable on a home value. So these are really very real issues for communities on the ground that go beyond just whether or not, you know, they want to get involved in what their theory of government is. They see it as a matter of existential threat. And what I find interesting is that most of the communities, and we're tracking over 450 local governments that have done something in this area, what I find interesting is that most of them reliably vote for Republicans. This is something that tends to be viewed as a local issue, and it's not a matter of ideology, like I said. It's just a matter of whether they're going to be viable in the future. Many of these towns don't have a private sector alternative, and in fact, many of them would love to embrace that. These towns have a variety of approaches to permitting and to right-of-way access. So it's not just a matter of them having barriers, because some cities do, and to different extents, some cities don't. But we still see that, for the most part, they're not getting the networks that they need. These networks are highly local. You know, whether or not a community is served, it's hard to tell if you're working at the state, certainly if you're working at the federal government. You simply don't know whether or not the local businesses and residents are well served. And I think that many of us, when we look at our cable bills and telephone bills, we recognize that, and we're very frustrated. And so whenever we talk in this call about whether or not the market's working, I encourage people to reflect for themselves whether they believe the government statistics that say there's tons of competition, most of those statistics coming from the cable and telephone industry and what I view as a rather corrupted form of crony capitalism and intermingling of these large businesses and government. But I want to get back to this. The local governments, they act often, and they've generally built these networks without using taxpayer dollars directly. You know, maybe we'll fight about the extent to which there's a subsidy with different financing mechanisms. I tend to think there's not, or at least it's de minimis. They've generally used revenue bonds, and in the vast majority of cases, they haven't missed a payment. Charles is right. There's some that have struggled. This is often in areas that are the hardest to build. So they're having success, not just in areas where the private sector is able to find success, but often in areas where the private sector is least interested in succeeding. You know, in areas of Tennessee right now, the federal government is paying AT&T to offer poor services via USF funds, Universal Service Funds, while the state of Tennessee refuses to allow nearby municipal networks that have not used a taxpayer dollar to expand their high-quality services to these rural areas at no cost to the taxpayers. I think that's absurd, and I find it frustrating. And I find it's very odd to say that the best way to use fewer taxpayer dollars in terms of expanding internet is to have local governments make more investments. I understand that may be very puzzling, and some people might just not accept it, but that's what we find. And I would say that if taxpayers are going to be involved in these situations, I think local taxpayers should be our preference rather than federal taxpayers or those who are paying into the USF fund. And so what I'll come back to time and time again is that these decisions should be made locally. People locally should be taking responsibility wherever possible. We'll be talking about law a little bit later, but I wanted to just say that without getting into the specific laws, I generally have a knee-jerk reaction that's against preemption, and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is like that as well. I support local authority, and this is a very rare case where we've found that federal preemption is one that enables local choice rather than removing it. When we're talking about preempting preemption in this case, and I'm sure this will be a fun one to discuss. I want to finish off by just saying that I'm very happy to talk about specific networks, and I can say, because people have told me many times, that it'll be hard to find someone who knows more in depth about all these different networks than me. I can talk very candidly about why some of them have failed, why Monticello had to give its bondholders a haircut, why Burlington's mayor screwed up with that system. And I can talk about networks that have failed, frankly, a few that I think Charles is unaware of. But what we found is that hundreds of networks have succeeded. They're paying their own way. And we have almost 20 years of experience now with a number of them. So the idea that we haven't had enough, I think, is false. But it's important to note that for most communities, they build these networks not to diversify their revenue, not to try and have, you know, some sort of windfall of dollars, but to have the network break even financially, just to pay its own way over a period of decades, while improving the business climate locally and the quality of life for the residents. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Randy for his introductory comments. Thank you very much again for having me.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Charles and Rachel, and most of all, the Federalist Society for hosting this call, which I think is important. This matter is important, I think, in a fundamental way because it involves the issue of federalism with regard to federal and state powers and relations, and obviously that would seem to be at the heart of what the Federalist Society is interested in. I am going to delve into the legal issues and even constitutional issue in just a moment, but I will say just briefly as a matter of policy, which Chris just talked about at some length, and Charles, I would associate myself more with the position of Charles, although it's never been my own position that in places where there is no other alternative, no private sector alternative, that there shouldn't or couldn't be a government-owned system if the states allow it. And I just make this further point, which hadn't been made explicitly, and that is when the government does get in the business of competing with private sector companies that are also offering the same service, there's an inherent conflict of interest, obviously, in a competitive sense. I think Chris mentioned permitting requirements and the like, rights of way issues, and so you have to understand that the local governments are in the position of making those decisions, which affect the private company's ability to offer services while also competing with them. And in general, we don't like to have situations like that, really, in our scheme of things in a competitive marketplace. Now, that said, to put it in clear terms, what you have here is the federal government telling the states that the states cannot restrict the activities of local governments that are created at the sufferance of the states. And so the government's telling the states that even though they wouldn't even have to create the localities, the counties or cities or whatever, that the states can't restrict their activities. I rarely make predictions about the outcome of cases, but I know Charles, I think, made a prediction on this one, and I feel pretty comfortable in saying that if this case gets to the Supreme Court, that the FCC will lose. Now, here's why. The FCC's decision that it had the authority to preempt the state restrictions on local governments was based on Section 706 of the Communications Act. Almost exclusively. I'm just going to read quickly the relevant section of 706. It says the commission and each state commission with regulatory jurisdiction over telecom services shall encourage the deployment of on a reasonable and timely basis of advanced telecommunications capability to all Americans by utilizing in a manner consistent with the public interest, convenience, and necessity, price cap regulation, regulatory forbearance, measures that promote competition in the local telecom market, or other regulating methods that remove barriers to infrastructure and investment. Note that it doesn't say anything about preemption in Section 706. And that's crucial to the legal argument because the Supreme Court has made clear in a number of cases that in order for the federal government to preempt state laws like this, that there has to be a clear statement, clear congressional statement authorizing that preemption, either by Congress or the agencies acting under congressional authority. I think I can say it's clear to me that here there's no such clear statement. Now there's background jurisprudence on this very issue that's relevant, and that's this. In the late 1990s, the FCC was act to preempt a Missouri law restricting municipal telecom provision. And the FCC itself found in that case that it lacked authority under Section 253 of the Communications Act, which was actually a preemption provision. In other words, much, much more to the point than Section 706, which I read. Section 253 says no state or local statute or regulation or other state or local legal requirement may prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the ability of any entity to provide any interstate or intrastate telecom service, close quote. And the FCC found that even under that provision, it lacked preemption authority. Now, that case actually went up to the Supreme Court. And remember, the FCC in that case was on the side of non-preemption. But in the case of Nixon versus Missouri Municipal League, that was decided in 2004, the Supreme Court rejected any authority of the FCC to preempt. It said there was no clear statement of congressional intent in the preemption statute to delegate preemptive authority to the FCC. Now, the issue there was whether any entity included a governmental entity or not. And the FCC had said it had to find that that was not the case. And the reason why that's not the case is because under a long line of Supreme Court cases, essentially the court had held that this clear statement doctrine was required in light of the traditional state power that would be implicated by preemption. And namely, in that case, and this is what the Supreme Court talked about, the state's control over their own political subdivisions. Remember, as I said, these are subdivisions that are created at state sufferance. Now, I can appreciate Chris's policy position that he prefers that decisions be made at a local level. I think he referred to the principle of subsidiarity, if I'm pronouncing that right. And that's all
yes.
That's all well and good, Chris. You know, maybe even neighborhoods are preferable for decision-making purposes rather than municipalities. But the reality is, as a matter of law, Chris, is that we don't have citizens of states. We don't have citizens of Wilson or Chattanooga, but we do have citizens of Tennessee and North Carolina, the two states involved in the appeal. And as much as you might prefer to look at your theory of democracy in a different way, under our Constitution, it's really the states and the federal government really that are the actors. So I just want to close. You know, there's a lot of jurisprudence on this, and we could go on. But I want to quote from the Supreme Court's decision in one of these cases that I've cited, where the court said the framers explicitly chose a constitution that confers upon Congress the power to regulate individuals, not states. The Constitution established, and I'm quoting, two orders of government, each with its own direct relationship, its own privity, its own set of mutual rights and obligations to the people who sustain it and are governed by it. Indeed, the Constitution thus contemplates that a state's government will represent and remain accountable to its own citizens, close quote. So in other words, you know, it's you may prefer that the decision be made at one level, but you or someone that advocates a position in favor of preemption are ignoring the right of the voters of the state to make a decision that they made to impose these restrictions. And just to end up to show you sort of the in my view, the absurdity of the whole this whole matter, the FCC acknowledges in this decision flat out that it doesn't have the authority if a state bans local governments from operating telecom systems or broadband systems outright, which some states do, as just ban these government-owned systems outright. The FCC says we can't do anything about that, as a matter of law. But if a state authorizes them and restricts them in some way, then we can preempt. Well, you know, on its face, to me, that position seems pretty absurd, because the state could adopt restrictions that, in effect, or as a practical matter, make it difficult, if not impossible, for GONs to operate. And you know, the FCC, you know, as a practical matter, that you know, has the same effect. So I'll stop with that and look forward to the discussion.
May I have just a minute to respond to that? I think we can. I won't drag on it.
Oh, absolutely. We'd all love to hear your views as well.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things that we can discuss, but I'll tell you that, frankly, when it comes down to the law, I certainly think that you've nailed it, Randy. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance perspective on cities is trumped by Dillon, Judge Dillon, our eternal nemesis, who, you know, in a whole line of thinking that comes along with that. But the FCC decision, I think, makes more sense than you give it credit for in the end there. And I think that this is one of the more readable FCC orders for people who just want to pick it up and see what the reasoning is. But the reasoning is basically that we can't tell states that they have to allow cities to provide broadband access. But the FCC reasoning is, and you know, the courts will certainly be looking at this, and Judge Silberman, who a Reagan appointee in the D.C. Circuit, he's the one that sort of got this all rolling. So it's not just a, you know, lunatics like me that don't have law degrees. But the argument is that once a state allows a city to be a service provider, regulating that service provider is something Congress has tasked the FCC to do, not states to do. And so I don't want to, you know, bore people with my legal analyses, but I just wanted to throw that in and say that that the FCC believes that it's standing on strong authority along those lines. I can't debate that question very well, but I certainly strongly encourage states on their own volition to remove these barriers, and I think we'll spend a lot more time talking in that direction.
Yeah, well, let me just, and then we'll I'll let Charles jump in too. But I, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to urge the states to remove the barriers. And I think I started by saying that I've never actually taken the position that in all circumstances municipalities, as a matter of policy, shouldn't be able to have guns if the private sector is not providing the service in the state, you know, allows it. But you know, with all due respect, Chris, I know the FCC, you know, believe, you know, it had to articulate its belief that along the lines that you've suggested, but you know, I think as I said, this is a fundamental matter of state federal relations, and I think at the end of the day, you know, I don't think the court is going to sustain the FCC's authority without, at least without a clear statement from Congress, because, you know, we have this clear statement doctrine. And you know, perhaps Congress could come back, enact another law and provide a clear statement, and you know, that would be more persuasive, I think, to courts if it did that.
Charles, do you have anything to add to this conversation?
I do a couple of points in response, one in response to this immediate conversation and one going back to a comment Chris made. On this immediate conversation, I tend to agree with Randy 100%. And, you know, despite what the FCC and others say, state legislators really have a compelling interest in this subject. You know, how a state subdivisions manage their finances, invest taxpayer funds, assume debt, manage their affairs generally, you know, has long been subject to some level of state oversight. And this is because I think, as everyone on the call knows and listening in, state government is ultimately responsible for what happens, you know, in the cities, towns, and counties that exist within its borders. So that is, in my opinion, a sort of a compelling argument as to why states need to have a role in this. The other comment I just wanted to offer was that, you know, with all due respect to Chris, and he's a great advocate and very knowledgeable and as smart as, you know, an attorney out there, the, you know, notions like crony capitalism, those are the types of notions I think that make this debate sometimes overly emotional, and they don't, you know, add to the merits of it. So let's examine that notion for a minute. When we look at the 1996 Telecommunications Act, we had Congress on a bipartisan basis that sort of very thoughtfully, after much debate, said we're going to take a hands-off light approach to the internet in general. And we saw Democrat and Republican FCCs embrace that approach. So what has been the result of what, you know, Chris would call crony capitalism? Well, we've seen 60 plus billion dollars invested annually since 2005. We've seen over $1 trillion invested since 1996. We've seen in this country the phenomenal development of the internet. We've seen robust innovation. We've seen lots of investment in this space. You know, the trend lines across every platform all are upward in the right direction. Speeds continue to increase year after year. You get more bang for the buck. Much more is offered for the level of service. There's much more capacity, and it's all been consumer driven. What else have we seen? And what other country have we seen the rise of Google, the rise of Facebook, the rise of Microsoft, the rise of Apple? And what other country do we see, you know, our internet service providers investing so much? So, you know, perhaps I'm a diehard proponent of capitalism, but I don't think it's been crony at all. Our elected officials took a very certain course of conduct in the 1996 Act, again, after much debate, and that course of conduct was followed until recently on a bipartisan basis, and we saw very good results. So I think that's a central context for all of this discussion when we're talking about what have we seen in the market. The other relevant point of context is when we're talking about municipalities and localities and states even investing in infrastructure, we've not done a very good job in this country. Our drinking water systems get a D. Our electric gets a D plus. Our bridges a C plus. Dams get a score of a D. Roads get a D. Schools get a D. And this is from the American Society of Civil Engineers. This is not data that's just sort of made up by people that want to say, oh, the counties haven't done a very good job. What's the end result? Nearly $4 trillion is required in investment by 2020 to shore up our infrastructure. So in my opinion, frankly, unless we see a compelling case for some type of government broadband, and I always think there's a solution via a partnership with private sector, but unless we see a compelling need somewhere, every dollar that a public entity, a locality, a city has to spare needs to be going to shore up our basic infrastructure, shore up our house before we start lining that house with flat screen TVs.
So this is Chris. I'd like to just offer a bit of a response. I would say first that I would like to see a lot more infrastructure investment across the board. I don't understand how government is going to be held responsible for the electrical system when we see time and time again after storms that it's the local 2,000 municipal systems that come back online immediately or don't have downtime when the large providers like National Grid fail to come up. I think it's more complicated than to just say it's all the public sector failure. On the compelling interest, states do have a compelling interest to, you know, make sure that cities are not, you know, running amok with their finances. What I find interesting is that, and this comes back to crony capitalism, and I wouldn't tar the 96 Act with that. I'm talking about these state house deals where often nobody's paying attention to what's happening. What happens is you have local governments that are involved in municipal networks. Yes, some of them have failed. We have never seen a city threatened with bankruptcy as a result of one. The investments just aren't that great. On the other hand, we see cities threatened with bankruptcy from failed interest rate swaps that they didn't understand, incinerator projects that go horribly over budget and put the cities put the city at severe risk, far greater than any municipal network ever has. So when you delve into the data and you're looking at this, you know, whether or not a city's finances are threatened, that does not explain why states are getting involved. But when you look into the lobbying money and you look at how the cable and telephone companies are unopposed in pushing these barriers, except for, you know, a few of us scattered around the United States who try to oppose millions of dollars on a per state per year basis, that's the only explanation for why states are suddenly concerned about the fiscal health of cities on a municipal network,
Chris,
which are a pretty
Chris.
Small item.
This is Randy, but, you know, I really have to take issue with that, and I think you're getting, you know, we could have good discussions about political theory sometime, but in this case, you know, when you talk about the realities of it, you're not addressing or you're ignoring the fact, as I pointed out, that when governments enter this business, they're competing with private sector companies that have, as Chuck said, invested, you know, millions or billions of dollars to create these systems. And that creates a conflict of interest. Now, you know, I said that there may be situations where that's unavoidable, but, you know, when you don't acknowledge that is part of a significant part of what motivates the states to focus on what the cities and counties are doing and adopt these restrictions, you know, I don't think you're presenting the full picture, because they have a legitimate interest in, you know, in that. And you know, I guess I would say, and we've studied. I initially didn't want to go into the systems, you know, one by one, but for people that want to do that, you know, they're more often than not, and I think you may concede this, really, if you looked at the whole range of experience, more often than not, there have been financial problems.
Absolutely not.
Systems. Well, I think that's the case when you look at the amount of, you know, when the government ends up, you know, having to. End up subsidizing. I think you said you didn't think the subsidies were that large, but I, you know, I think they have been in some cases. They have to issue more bonds. It's I think there've been some pretty bad experiences. You know,
there have been some. Now Spanish Fork, Utah just finished paying off all of its debt early. Cedar Falls finished off paying its debt early. That was one that was written many years as a failure. You know, we've seen it's very rare to find where cities have not been able to make their debt payments. We see the bonders the bondholders are willing to keep buying this kind of debt. You know, we see credit ratings continue to go up. Charles, in your paper, you know, you want to talk about the data. You talked about how Chattanooga's bond rating was initially lowered as a result of issuing the debt. And curiously, you didn't note that months later they restored it because of the strength of the network. And in fact, even one of your footnotes was a story that specifically talked about that. But in your article, you only talked about how their rating had been lowered. There's numerous occasions in which cities' bond ratings have been improved as a result of this, because it helps the overall business climate of the community. Now, I think one of the issues that I'd really like to deal with, Randy, is a question of this, which I have for you. Some municipal networks do not engage in direct competition with the private sector, and in fact, their goal is to build an open network that would lower the barriers of entry so that small local ISPs are able to compete with a Comcast without having to raise the insane amounts of capital that are actually a barrier to entry. And I'm curious whether you have an opposition to those situations where the city is not engaging in service-level competition, but is instead enabling multi-party competition by lowering this barrier to entry.
Yeah, no, I do, and I'll tell you why, and then maybe we ought to open it up to the audience. The reason why that's problematical for me, Chris, is that when cities do that, they're essentially establishing, you know, a resale mechanism. I mean, they become a wholesaler for resellers to then offer services. As you put it, the ISPs. But in effect, what that does is really discourage the private sector from investing in building out its own facilities and owning and operating networks. And it is really only through facilities-based competition and not this, you know, this resale competition through so-called open access that you ultimately get sustainable competition that benefits consumers. So, you know, that's for the same reason that I, you know, oppose, you know, net neutrality and, you know, open access. Same reason Bill Kennard opposed open access back in the late 1990s. It just has the effect over the medium to long term of discouraging new investment, which is really what's important, to benefit consumers, even though there might be, you know, very short-term gains. So, yeah, that's my response.
Chris, before we give you an opportunity to respond to what Randy said, and Charles, feel free to jump in as well, we'd like to open it up to audience questions as well. Dean, are there any special instructions?
Yeah, let me push a couple buttons here. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see, let me make our typical commercial announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at noon Eastern Time, you can join us in person at Covington and Burling's D.C. office for our first ever teleforum with a live audience. Deb Garza, a partner there, will be interviewing former FTC Commissioner Josh Wright. That's tomorrow at noon. You can check our website for details on how to RSVP. Then Wednesday at noon, we'll be discussing civil juries. Thursday, again at noon, we're going to have an update on the CFPB. And then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be previewing the coming terms class action litigation docket. Today, of course, we're talking about municipal broadband. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller question pending, then our lines will be wide open. So let's go to our first call.
Greetings. May I ask my question?
Please do. We can hear you fine.
Okay. Very good. My name is Drew Clark. I'm at Curtin McConkie. Nice to hear all of your voices, Randy, Charles. Great to hear you, Chris. We just saw each other last week. I'd like to continue on the theme of sort of the public-private partnership, the wholesale access. Chris just asked a question about the notion of the municipality not being a retail player, but offering a platform for a range of competitors. I'd like to get all three of your perspectives on what differences do you see now or in the future between another type of common infrastructure, a highway or a road or other forms of infrastructure, and this wholesale access or even just conduit access to a fiber optic facility. In other words, Charles, Randy, Chris, what is it exactly that's different between a road and a fiber optic conduit? And would you or can you conceive of circumstances where you would endorse a multi-party use of such networks, just as I presume you endorse, uses of public highways and roads? Obviously, rights of way being such that even if we did want to have private roads, it would be rather hard to, negotiate the public goods problems with those private roads. So love all three of your reactions to that point.
This is Charles. I'll take a stab at that. I would like to add a footnote in response to Chris's point, just to mention that our updated Chattanooga case study will, in fact, reflect that credit upgrade. And with regard to your question, Drew, and then that piggybacks on what Randy and Chris were talking about, Randy made a great point about investment incentives when we have government building some component of the network. And at least implicit in your question was that the current approach really sort of doubles down on one technology, fiber, at a time when, as a matter of policy, I would respectfully suggest we should be embracing continued intermodal competition, which has been robust to date. And, for many, wireless only is a play, and that leads into the very pressing need for reforming spectrum policy in this country. But this intermodal competition, which you don't see in other parts of the globe, is really what makes our broadband market so unique and so innovative. We shouldn't try and undermine that by going all in on fiber. Now, that's not to say that there shouldn't be public-private partnerships designed to increase connectivity on the supply and demand side. I think there are many paths forward for those partnerships on both supply and demand issues. But policies to date have really worked, by and large, to spur this network premised on robust intermodal competition throughout virtually all of the country. I mean, we have pockets that are challenges and we do have to deal with. Also implicit in your question is there a difference between this type of network and other types of physical infrastructure? And I would say absolutely yes, with three exclamation points behind that. Physical infrastructure is arguably a type of infrastructure that's much easier to maintain in the long run compared to very dynamic infrastructure that goes into broadband networks that makes up the internet. That infrastructure is something that has to be managed, constantly upgraded, invested in, requirement for skilled personnel. It's a very, very challenging endeavor in a world where cities, localities, municipalities, states are facing still looming financial crises. Despite, upgrades in particular cities' bond ratings, across the board, we've got in many states across the country public pensions that are underfunded by 25 to 50%. We have school budgets being cut. We have social programs, being cut. The reality is government cannot be all things to all people. So in a situation where we have had the private sector step up to the plate and invest billions annually in this infrastructure and trillions over the long haul, maybe this isn't the right space for government, even at the local level, to be stepping in. So ultimately, local officials just need to be assessing priorities, budgets, money, their infrastructure, and asking.
Charles, can I jump in?
We have competition.
This is Chris. I'm sorry. I was hoping we would get to another call or two, and I wanted to I'm going to try and keep my comments really brief. I would say one of the questions that comes to mind, and I think spurs your question, Drew, is whether or not the current system's working. And I read about how much the industry is investing, and I understand they're investing a whole lot of money. They have a whole lot of money to invest. The market's failed in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'll tell you that. We've got two providers, Comcast and CenturyLink. Comcast is the only one really offering high speed in my neighborhood. There's a few areas of town where you can get something better from CenturyLink. But for the most part, Comcast pretty much has a monopoly on people that want fast speeds. Now, they've just doubled my speeds, and I think that's a sign that Charles would point to as success. And they've pointed out very helpfully that they had not charged me for the upgrade. Since the last time they doubled my speeds about 2.5 years ago, my bill had gone up $20 a month. And I'll just say to people that, you can look at all these statistics, most of which come from the federal government, which get them from the companies themselves. But ask yourself whether or not the market is working. And I'll say it's not. Our speeds have gone up. The providers have invested a lot of money. They have large workforces, which is part of the reason they're so powerful in state legislatures. But fundamentally, I would say this system's not working. And that's why we see cities that are trying to, even large cities, that are trying to figure out how to spur investment. And sometimes they decide they have to do it themselves. Sometimes they partner. But frankly, I think that if we actually want to have real choice that doesn't just turn back into two or three options that are colluding with each other, I think we need to have some kind of open infrastructure. And I very much disagree with Randy. And you know, maybe some future time we could have a call just on that.
Well, I'm going to forbear from saying anything so we can get another caller in if we have one, except say hello to my friend Drew Clark, who I appreciate his participation.
Well, thank you for your kindness, but I still feel a little bit as though I haven't got a full answer as to the exact distinction between the public letting an RFI to have the private sector construct a highway versus the public letting an RFI to have the private sector construct an open access network that companies can attach to. I'd love a philosophical distinction there from Charles or Randy that I'm not hearing one yet.
Well, here,
this is
let me
Dean.
Try
let me,
it,
Randy,
let me
before
it,
you go on, but, let me break in. This is Dean, just to let you know we don't have any other questions pending. So if you want to take this more fully, go right ahead, Randy.
Okay, well, I'll take it a little more fully, and maybe we'll have another question or can continue on this subject. Look, Drew, there are no clear demarcations that say highways. Government only, and telecom broadband, private sector only. But that said, the reality is most from the beginning of the country's history, most of our roads and highways were undertaken by the government and thought of as a government function, and that's where the money came from. And it was the as you probably know, there are places now, including California, and I can name some others, where, you know, when additional roads are desired by the public and where the government is actually turning to the private sector to build and operate those roads on a toll basis. And, you know, we have examples of that. And in part, that's because of as Charles has explained, you know, there's a limited amount of money that governments have, and we all know about that. But so in a situation where it's possible to have competition, it's not perfect, and you know, Chris talks about he would always like more competition, and you know, we all would, if the economics supported it. But we have, in most places, we do have competition, and the companies, believe me, don't collude with each other, because all you have to do is watch their advertisements attacking one another. When you have companies willing to invest the money, private sector capital, because a market can be competitive using different technological platforms, and that's an important point, then, you know, that ought to be the preferred way to go, and, you know, as a matter of policy, I think. Now, again, we sort of put the legal issue to the background, but in my view, states, you know, do have the authority, and under our system ought to have the authority to make decisions about whether restrictions are appropriate or not.
So I this is Charles. I'd like to just follow up with what Randy said, and Drew, hopefully give a more direct response to your question. And that response would be one sentence. Unlike with virtually every other utility service or public infrastructure, broadband, by and large, can be provided competitively by multiple private firms, period. Now, follow up again, it's not perfect. Nothing is, as Randy pointed out, but I think that's the distinguishing principle. And if possible, I'd like to just ask Chris a similar question in a different space. Chris, in your opinion, would, if a locality just wanted to come in and use public funds to
build its own grocery store that might compete with Publix, Winn-Dixie, Kroger, Piggly Wiggly, whatever. Would that be okay?
Well, I think I'll answer that in a way that I find useful, which is to say, do I believe that a city should have the authority to decide on its own to build that? Yes. If I was on the city council and there was a competitive market, would I vote to do that? Absolutely not. And so the question ultimately is, once again, and I think this is why it has to be local, you have to know what's going on. Now, if vegetables are $10 a pound and $15 a pound from the only one or two grocery stores in town, then yeah. And in fact, we've seen rural towns in the Dakotas that create a general store because of a lack, and they subsidize it maybe because of they don't want their people to have to drive 75 miles to the next clearest space. So I would just say that it's hard to have a distinction on that. But in general, I do put my faith in the local public, and I do so knowing that in some cases they're going to get it wrong, and I'm comfortable with that. I just think the decision should be up to them to be made, where they have both the opportunity, but they also have to live with the consequences of a bad decision. And I'll just say once again that I don't know of a single instance in which a municipal network that has not succeeded has impacted those beyond its borders. Certainly no states have taken on obligations from cities where networks have failed.
Thanks for
that. Our lines are still open, Rachel. Let me just make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Rachel, we've got about 4 more minutes left, so maybe here's another question. Did you want to ask a question, Rachel, or should we continue on with the audience?
No, let's let the audience have at it.
Okay, let's carry on.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I live in rural Washington State. We're in the mountains, and I'll just try to frame this. I know we're running out of time. Over the years, if people wanted internet at all, we had to buy our own satellite dishes, which those who were willing to do, we stepped up to the plate. Government became involved, and they proposed public to put together a broadband network, and those of us who had already connected were going to confront surcharges on our phone lines and our other services to support those who had put it off or never taken on, I shouldn't call it a burden. It really hasn't been a burden. My big concern now, we have Frontier here that now carries DSL over phone line, and whatever it seems to me infrastructure problem there might have been in terms of having, they used to talk about fiber optic backbone, all this other business, bonds were sold, grants were given. Now Frontier is offering DSL on phone lines, and my question would be this to people who are proponents: how could government possibly keep up with the changes in technology? You know, 10 years ago, DSL wasn't available over phone lines. Now it is. All of these cities, all of these locales who have installed expensive fiber optics are carrying the burden.
Sure.
People
will
be paying
taxes. That before we run out
I think
of time.
That's okay. How can they keep up with the technology?
It's an excellent question.
Thank you.
And I often say that. And I'll just a modest correction. DSL has been available. It's one of the earliest forms of broadband. But these are hard technical issues. People often get confused about that. And I think cities have to do their due diligence. But over 100 years ago, all of these arguments were made with regard to electrification, a technology that killed people when they got it wrong. And there was, look back at the newspapers, people were dying. Cities proved for over 100 years. Now, don't tell me that broadband's more difficult. I think if you look back at what electrification was at in the year 1900s, it was. And so I would just say empirically we've seen that cities on some matters can keep up, and we've seen that.
We've got about 60 seconds left, Rachel.
Great. I'd love to get everyone's just closing thoughts, looking into your crystal ball. What do you think is next in relation to municipal broadband networks? Will we continue to see cities and localities petition the FCC individually? Will we see a blanket policy? What do you all think is coming down the pike?
Well, this is Randy. I'll just go first, and I'll go back to the the legal aspect. I think we'll probably see some other cities petition the FCC because the FCC has invited the petitions. But I do think that I predict this case, again, if it ultimately reaches the Supreme Court, that the FCC will lose because basically, and this is what it comes down to, we don't often express it this way, but we don't really have citizens, you know, in any legal sense of cities, Chattanooga, but we do have citizens of Tennessee, and when they express their will through state law, then it's ultimately, you know, going to prevail over the municipalities, absent a very, very clear statement of preemption from Congress.
I think we'll see a few petitions. I'm hoping we'll see 1,000 flowers bloom in the areas where cities do have the authority, and that the states will just on their own volition recognize that it's foolish to take this decision out of the hands of local people.
This is Charles. I think we will see, like with so many other issues in our current national dialogue, a wide split of opinion on a number of fronts. There are just major philosophic differences here. I hope that we see more rigorous data-driven analyses by local officials, state officials that are looking at these issues and asking of the tough questions. Does this make financial sense? Is there a positive return on our investment? Are we going into a deep hole here? What are the risks? What are the benefits? Ultimately, we need more data-driven analyses so that decisions at all levels of government are as informed as possible.
Well, thanks to all three of you, Charles, Randy, and Chris, and to the audience who joined us today. Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this recording will be available shortly, correct?
It will. This is Dean Reuter, and I want to thank join Rachel in thanking our three experts, and let me thank you, Rachel, for moderating today. We certainly appreciate your time. As you've suggested, the link to the recorded podcast for this will be available within about 24 hours. It could be later today, but it's more likely to be available tomorrow. It'll be available on the Federal Society's website, and I urge you to find it and forward it to anyone you think might be interested in listening to today's teleform. Thanks to the audience also for joining, and a reminder that our next scheduled teleform is tomorrow at noon. We'll be doing an in-person live audience teleform from Covington and Burling. You can join by telephone at this number. That's tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.